This program is intended for individuals who are blind or are unable to read physical print and is brought to you by CABVI's Audio Information Services team.
The first hour of the Cincinnati Enquirer on Mondays is brought to you through generous underwriting from the Northeastern Lions Club.
Hello, my name is Mary Capicella. Today is Monday, April 29th, 2024, and I'll be reading from the Cincinnati Enquirer, the business, editorials, and local and national news. We'll start with the business section. The article is entitled Trailside Village, What's Next in Highly Anticipated West Side Mixed Use Development. A mixed use development coming to Green Township is taking shape with land available to buy this summer. Trailside Village has been a West Side hot topic due to its location on the continuously developing Harrison Avenue corridor and its unique design. Known as a conservation development, it is a private-public partnership aimed at preserving the natural features surrounding the Green Township bike and walk trail. It is the first conservation development in Hamilton County. Plans for the new neighborhood have been in the works for years, to the excitement of some neighbors who look forward to features like retail and dining options, but to the chagrin of others upset with changes in the ever-developing community called Dent. Still, elected officials say the development is for everyone, not just for future residents. With the established 8-year-old bike trail as a draw and an aim to preserve environmental features, officials hope the walkable neighborhood will preserve some of the land's rural charm while drawing in non-residents with entertainment components. Tony Rosiello, Green Township Board of Trustees, says, quote, "The West Side, I think, is poised for the future for these families to raise their children here. With strong public safety, schools, and other community assets, all of this comes together in the package of this is where you want to raise your family." Trailside Village will be a neighborhood with nature at the forefront. It will be rolled out in several phases, with the first consisting of single-family homes and the second featuring mixed-use development of apartments, plus retail and dining options. It is being developed by Benkin and Associates. Builders assigned to the project are M&I Homes and Dennis Ott Builders. Walkability is one of the premier features of the development, preserving green space and creekside areas and highlighting them as community gathering spaces. Plots will be available to buy in July or August, according to Township Administrator Frank Birkenhauer. Gas, water, and sewer are already in place, as are streets and the main drive into the neighborhood. However, there are still no model homes built. Plots for custom homes also will be available. Phase one includes 195 lots of residential development, including 90 trailside and creekside row house style standalone homes with attached garages, 84 traditional homes, and 21 estate homes. The bike trail will be extended from 1.1 miles to 2.6 miles as part of the first phase. The development also will add a nature play area, a small performance lawn, and an open-air pavilion. Rosiello said talks are still underway on what will happen with the apartments and retail and dining options. It is still undecided whether the apartments will go on the second and third floor of a building with commercial development on the first floor, or a freestanding building with commercial development separate. Conservation developments will allow residential and commercial development to exist while protecting an area's environmental features. They are designed so that the layout of the land parcel conserves nature resources while allowing development to occur at the same density as the underlying zoning, according to Ohio's Balanced Growth Program. To qualify as a conservation development, at least 40% of the land must be maintained as green space. Trailside Village one-ups that mark with retaining more than 50%, or 55 acres, as perpetual green space. More than 250 trees will be planted along greenways, trails, and individual properties. Wildlife crossings will allow animals to traverse the community safely. When Nick Fernanding moved into his Philview Circle family home in 2000 after his grandfather died, he didn't sign up for a massive mixed-use development on what used to be a scenic horse farm just beyond his backyard. "This thing here was a Trojan horse," he said, citing what he says was a lack of transparency on the township's end on how the area would be developed. His neighbor, Joy Mahuta, attended public meetings to push back on any development off of Hutchinson Road. Fernanding said unwelcome riffraff, like late-night visitors having sex on cars in parking lot, has become more common through the years. Plus, property taxes have gone up. Rosiello called it the quote, Coney Island syndrome, referencing the ongoing uproar of Coney Island's closure in Anderson Township earlier this year. "There is a lot of interest from empty nesters," Birkenhauer said. Officials also hope to attract new young people living on the west side for the first time. But some current Dent residents are looking forward to what the development will bring. For 38 years, Sandy Hoskins has lived on Lee Court, just past the second entrance to the bike trail behind the Harrison Green Mini Lifestyle Center that houses Dewey's Pizza, Grater's, and First Watch. She has seen the Harrison Avenue corridor become less rural as the township allowed more suburban sprawl, but the development is a welcome change. She loves the bike path and is looking forward to the Trailside Village and the new entertainment district it will bring. She says, quote, "Something was going to happen there anyway. I'd rather it be that." Plot for the model homes will be available to purchase this summer. Future development on the Trailside Village Center, part of Phase 2, will be located along Harrison Avenue. It will feature additional housing units and 35,000 square feet of commercial space. That will include the Village Center, which will offer a mix of dining options as well as retail and office space. And now we switch to the editorial section. The first editorial is entitled, "Cincinnatians Divided Over Whether Reds Legend Pete Rose Belongs in the Hall of Fame." This is the opinion of Daniel Sewell, and it reads, "My suggestion that it's time for Major League Baseball to end Pete Rose's lifetime ban for betting on baseball got scores of responses by email and on social media, roughly divided evenly between agreement and those seeing red about the idea. After nearly 35 years of punishment, and with Rose at the age of 83, following the deaths of three big Red Machine teammates so far this year, and the earlier loss of the great Joe Morgan, I think it would be appropriate to allow his many fans the chance to see and celebrate his induction into the National Baseball Hall of Fame while he's still here. Some also see hypocrisy in his continued punishment as baseball embraces ties to gambling. Opponents say he knowingly violated the cardinal rule meant to protect baseball's integrity, that he shows little contrition, and his case worsened with a woman's assertion a few years ago that he had a sexual relationship when she was underage. Here's a sampling of responses. Quote, Pete Rose has already paid a steep price for his transgressions. I believe it's long past time for MLB to be merciful and allow Rose into the hall while still living. In doing so, it would be liberating for baseball to finally be able to put this dark chapter in the rear view and move on from Buck. And the next one. Nope, nope, nope. To condone what he did at a time when gambling is taking over professional sports is to send a message to today's pros that the standards have changed and it's okay to cheat. Nope, that's from Heather. And the next feedback. Forgiveness requires sincere contrition. I don't see that. Baseball might seem hypocritical with its alliances with legalized gambling, but one thing has not changed. In-uniform players are not allowed to bet on baseball in any form. The next one. Wasn't a perfect person and made some mistakes, but was great at his job. How long can you stick it to one man for a mistake? It's a bit absurd. That's from Samuel. And the next. Sorry, but to a person with a conscience, none of Pete Rose's baseball accomplishments will ever negate the fact that he is an abysmal human being worthy of no such prestige or accolades. From GV. And the next from David E. If you were building a museum of morally upright citizens, you for sure would not include Pete in it. If you were building a hall of guys who did amazing things on the baseball field, you sure would. And the next opinion letter is entitled Futures Commission. Recycled tax and spend policies cloud city's bright future. This is the opinion of Greg R. Lawson. And it reads, the Cincinnati Futures Commission, assembled by Mayor Aftab Purival, projects a nearly $500 million budget shortfall for the city by 2033. That is bad news. And it gets worse. The commission's recent report includes strong policy recommendations that city officials and civic leaders should embrace, such as divesting unproductive assets, selling 6 municipal golf courses, leasing the Lunkin Airport, and re-envisioning city properties not yielding top value. But the report then reverts to recycling a tax and spend agenda that has failed everywhere it has been tried and calls for raising Cincinnati's municipal income tax from 1.8 to 1.95%. Cincinnati's 1.8% income tax is a competitive advantage. It helps the city attract and retain workers by allowing them to keep more of their paychecks than other big Ohio cities do. Columbus and Cleveland, for example, tax income at 2.5%. But the majority of Cleveland's suburban municipalities tax income at least 2%, with some like Bedford and Palmer Heights taking up to 3% of wages. While Cincinnati competes for workers and residents against low tax centers like Loveland and Blue Ash, which charge just 1 and 1.25 respectively. And many large townships in Southwest Ohio levy no municipal income tax at all. The higher Cincinnati's income tax climbs, the less its advantage and the harder it will be to keep earners and businesses from leaving. The General Assembly has been busy reforming the state income tax to make Ohio regionally more competitive by streamlining tax brackets and moving toward a single flat rate. But the Cincinnati Futures Commission recommends the city tax take the opposite approach, raise income tax rates, and put the bulk of any increased revenue into an economic development slush fund for the politically well-connected. See, the bad news got worse. Tax and spend initiatives do not develop or grow economies. They do not spur innovation. They do not attract new talent or encourage more investment. Instead, they siphon money, taxes, from the productive private sector, funnel it through an administrative bureaucracy that must be paid, and then repurpose the money as government officials see fit. And only rarely is that ever the most efficient or effective use of the remaining money. Rather than retread this failed financial cycle, Cincinnati leaders should carefully reconsider how to free up money to pay for core government services, public safety, and infrastructure without hiking taxes or running up a $500 million deficit over the next 10 years. One long-term reform that could help reduce city costs, for example, would be shifting Cincinnati's expensive but underfunded public pension plan from a defined benefit system to a defined contribution system. The Buckeye Institute suggested this sustainable solution more than a decade ago. But the city continues to prefer the proverbial Band-Aid of short-sighted fixes rather than stitching the gaping fiscal wound to stop the bleeding. The Cincinnati Futures Commission has made some valuable recommendations for city officials to consider, and they should. But raising municipal income tax rates for a civic development slush fund is not among them. And returning to outmoded tax and spend policies instead of creatively curbing public spending and attracting more workers, more residents, and more businesses will cost the city in the long run, perhaps even more than $500 million. Again, that was written and is the opinion of Greg R. Lawson, who is a research fellow at the Buckeye Institute and is the author of multiple reports on local government reform. And now we move to the local news. First article is entitled, Virginia PAC Targeted Rhino Candidates. Mysterious mailers stamped Democrat asset across the faces of Ohio March House Republicans running in the March primary were delivered to homes earlier this year. One flyer accused a lawmaker of being lazy and absent. Another alleged a legislator took advantage of poor single mothers. The mailers came from Make Liberty Win, a Virginia-based libertarian hybrid PAC that advocates for universal school vouchers, no income tax, and no local enforcement of federal gun laws. The group spent $1.7 million targeting Ohio House Republicans in the primary and plans to spend money in the November election too. The people of Ohio deserve GOP majorities that govern like Republicans, not a cabal of closet Democrats bought and sold by the Columbus swamp, Make Liberty Win's executive director Barrett Young wrote in an email. Make Liberty Win is one of several groups, including Ohio's Americans for Prosperity chapter, that campaigned against Republican incumbents who backed Representative Jason Stevens, Republican from Kitts Hill, for Ohio House Speaker. In early 2023, Stevens won the role with support from House Democrats, a fact that enraged some fellow Republicans. The March primary turned into a referendum on Stevens' speakership and a fight for the gavel in 2025 as current Senate President Matt Huffman openly campaigned for Stevens' job. Make Liberty Win's efforts had mixed results in Ohio. Two of its four endorsed GOP candidates won their primaries, and five Republicans who backed Stevens for Speaker lost their races. On its website, the group displayed the five primary losers on orange tags with the phrase, quote, bagged and tagged, evidence of a successful RINO, Republican in name only, hunt. We based our campaigns on facts and will always operate with truth and transparency because Ohio voters deserve that, says Jared Borg, executive director of House Republicans' campaign arm called the Ohio House Republican Alliance. Ohio became a target for us because we saw how bad the policy environment was for limited government. Make Liberty Win is largely funded by Austin-based Young Americans for Liberty, a libertarian student activism organization formed after Ron Paul's 2008 presidential campaign. Young Americans for Liberty is a 501 nonprofit that is not required to disclose its donors. These are often called, quote, dark money groups. But tax filings indicate the organization has received donations from groups aligned with the conservative Koch brothers, according to the Influence Watch. Five Ohio Republican lawmakers are on Young Americans for Liberty's coalition of pro-liberty legislators, including Representative Ron Ferguson, who has spoken at the group's annual conventions. Make Liberty Win has elected small government, pro-personal liberty lawmakers in states like New Hampshire, Texas, Kentucky, and Tennessee. Nashville's WTVF revealed that Make Liberty Win was a part of an effort to oust Tennessee lawmakers who backed the state's public schools and opposed the privatization of education. Representative Adam Matthews, Republican from Lebanon, was in Make Liberty Win's good graces until he wasn't. Make Liberty Win endorsed Matthews' successful House bid in 2022. As a lawmaker, the Lebanon Republican sponsored a bill to eliminate Ohio's income tax and voted to expand private school vouchers, two top priorities of Make Liberty Win. Matthews even voted for Stevens' opponent in 2023 speaker race. So Matthew was surprised when Make Liberty Win targeted him with a slew of negative mailers earlier this year. They seemed to like my pro-school choice, pro-limited government view of things, Matthews said. And then this last time, he said, they were very upset with me working to pass a budget that resulted in $2.2 billion of income tax cuts, kept the Western and Southern, now the Cincinnati Open, in Ohio, and provided universal school choice for Ohio students. Young pushed back against Ohio's expanding school vouchers, saying it wasn't fully funded or thought through. He wrote, quote, a real universal school choice bill gives every student an equal chance to succeed rather than playing favorites. And the next article is entitled, Ohio Lawmakers to MLB. It's time to let Rose into the Baseball Hall of Fame. Two state lawmakers are asking the Major League Baseball Commissioner to lift the ban on Pete Rose from entering the National Baseball Hall of Fame. From the standpoint of talent in the game, there's nobody better. Period, says State Rep Bill Seitz, a Republican from Green Township in suburban Cincinnati. He called it, quote, hypocritical that major league teams are now heavily invested in sports betting operations, but gambling is still held against Rose. Sites and State Rep Tom Young, a Republican from Washington Township near Dayton, are co-sponsoring the resolution backing Rose for the Hall of Fame. Resolutions have no legal force. Last year, Major League Baseball Commissioner Rob Manfred said fans being allowed to bet on sports doesn't change anything when it comes to players betting. I 100% believe if you bet on baseball, you should be banned from baseball for life, he said. Rose is now 83 years old. Seitz said, quote, the wide belief down in Cincinnati is that they'll probably put him in the Hall of Fame when he's dead. In an interview in 2020, Rose said, quote, I screwed up. I should have never bet on baseball. That's the only mistake I've ever made in my life, to be honest with you. And that's the big mistake. I would love to go to the Hall of Fame. Any player would. But as long as this heart is beating, I'm not going to the Hall of Fame. Rose, whose nickname was Charlie Hustle, played for the Reds from 1963 to 1986. During and after his playing career, he managed the Reds from 84 to 89. Rose became the all-time leader in hits, games played, and at bats, and he won three World Series. He was banned from baseball in 1989 over allegations that he bet on baseball while a player and a manager. 2 years later, the Hall of Fame decided to block from induction anyone on the banned list. And the next article is entitled, Probation for Teen in Sexual Assault Case. One of the three students accused of sexually assaulting a classmate at Wyoming High School was sentenced to probation Wednesday. The student, 15, at the time of the offense, pleaded guilty to felonious assault, abduction, and hazing as a part of a plea deal. Of the three teens facing charges, his were the most severe. Juvenile prosecutor Leah Dinklager asked for the teen to be sentenced to detention in a state facility. Magistrate Latoya Maley gave the teen a suspended sentence, meaning he will stay out of detention unless he breaks the law or fails to obey rules of his probation. He will remain on probation until the age of 21. Maley has also ordered the teen to participate in therapy. The teen's lawyer, Mark Crumbine, said his client spent 2.5 weeks in detention at the Hamilton County Youth Center and nearly a year on house arrest. Crumbine said the teen is now attending school online and has no plan to return to Wyoming High School. The two other teens are 16. One has pleaded guilty to abduction and hazing, but his sentencing was continued on Wednesday to June 3rd. Last April, the three teens, who were freshmen, dragged the victim into the locker room 4 times as he tried to escape, prosecutors said. The victim was then violated when he could no longer get away. The incident happened after school during a sports practice, and surveillance footage captured portions of the attack that happened outside of the locker room, investigations say. It is unclear if the two other co-defendants are still attending Wyoming City Schools. The district told the Enquirer it cannot release that information due to state and federal laws. None of the teens have had any prior contact with the juvenile court, their lawyers said. The Enquirer has not named the accused teens due to their ages. And the next article is entitled, This Pest is Emerging in Cincinnati, How to Report Invasive Species. An invasive destructive pest has been found again in Cincinnati. The Ohio Department of Agriculture confirmed on Wednesday that spotted lanternfly nymphs have begun to emerge in the Cincinnati area this week. Spotted lanternflies first reached eastern Ohio in 2020. Under Ohio law, they are designated destructive plant pests. In the past, they have been found in counties Columbiana, Cuyahoga, Erie, Franklin, Hamilton, Jefferson, Lorain, Lucas, Mahoning, Muskingum, and Ottawa. Here is what you should know. According to the Buckeye Yard and Garden Online, the spotted lantern fly is a non-native invasive plant hopper that has been confirmed to be found in 12 Ohio counties. Spotted lantern flies feed on the sap of trees, vines, and perennials, such as fruit trees, hops, maple, willow, and walnut. However, the species favors the tree of heaven and wild and cultivated grapes. Nymphs are juvenile spotted lantern flies, per the U.S. Department of Agriculture. They are strong jumpers and may be found on various plants around their hatch location. The invasive species are native to Asia, but first appeared in U.S. in Pennsylvania in 2014, likely brought over by imported woody plants, wood products, and other goods. Spotted lanternfly nymphs are approximately 1/4 inch long and may be mistaken for ticks. They are typically black with white spots. The adult lanternfly is approximately 1 inch long and 1/2 inch wide. They typically have black bodies, red and gray wings, and black markings. The Ohio Department of Agriculture confirmed the first sighting and egg hatch of spotted lantern nymphs in Cincinnati on Wednesday, April 24th. Nymphs were collected on young trees of heaven, one of the species' preferred plants. According to the Pennsylvania Department of Agriculture, the spotted lanternfly can cause damage, including oozing sap, wilting, leaf curling, and dieback to trees, crops, vines, and other plants. When spotted lanternflies feed, they excrete honeydew, a sugary substance that can encourage the growth of sooty black mold. This mold is harmless to people, but can damage plants. Due to nymph feeding patterns, honeydew may be found on nearby plants and other surfaces through the spring, which could attract other insects, such as wasps and butterflies. The USDA recommends checking outdoor items for spotted lanternfly egg masses, including any items you may bring indoors during the winter. If you find egg masses, scrape them into a plastic zippered bag with hand sanitizer or rubbing alcohol, then zip the bag shut and properly dispose. Look for egg masses on trees and outdoor plants, especially at dusk or at night, when the insects tend to gather in large groups on trunks and stems. Also, make sure to check car doors, sides, bumpers, wheel wells, grills, and roofs, as spotted lantern flies are also known to enter vehicles. If you suspect a spotted lantern fly infestation, take a picture or collect a sample and report the finding to the ODA Plant Pest Control using the Ohio Plant Pest Reporter. And the next article is entitled Ranking Top 25 Public High Schools in Ohio. U.S. News and World Report has released its ranking of the country's top public high schools, and over 700 Ohio schools made the rankings. To determine its top schools, U.S. News and World Report pulled information from statewide standardized testing results, graduation rates, College Board and exam data, and the U.S. Department of Education's Common Core of data. In the review of about 25,000 public schools, 705 Ohio schools made the ranking. The top-ranked schools were found to have a high rate of students who scored above average in math, science, and reading assessments, passed college-level exams, and graduated in 4 years. Here are the top 25 Ohio schools according to U.S. News & World Report. Number one, Walnut Hills High School in Cincinnati. Next, Bexley High School, Bexley. Madeira High School, Cincinnati. Solon High School. Rocky River High School in Rocky River. Oakwood High School in Dayton. Chagrin Falls in Chagrin Falls. Indian Hill High School in Cincinnati. Hudson High School. Dublin Jerome High School. Olentangy Liberty High. Wyoming High School in Wyoming. Brecksville Broadville Heights. Olentangy High School, Kinston, Columbus, Sycamore High School, Cincinnati, William Mason High School in Mason, Grandview Heights in Columbus, Aurora High School, Upper Arlington High School, Ottawa High School in Toledo, Granville High in Granville, Bay High School in Bay Village, and Turpin High School in Cincinnati. Here are the best public high schools in Northern Kentucky, according to their place of the on the U.S. News & World Report's ranking of Kentucky top schools. The Enquirer looked at high schools in Boone, Campbell, and Kenton and ranked within the top 50 in the state. Highlands High School was number 3 in the state. Beechwood was number 5. Ludlow High was number 18. Campbell County was number 20, Larry A. Ryle was number 28, and Randall K. Cooper was number 43. Highlands High School, Northern Kentucky's top high school, ranked number 263 nationally. And the next article is entitled, Canton Releases Video of Man's Fatal Arrest. Frank Tyson's last words were, quote, I can't breathe. The city of Canton released 9/11 calls and body camera footage Wednesday night showing Tyson's arrest and struggle with two police officers last week. Tyson, 53 years of age, who lived in the East Canton area, died after being taken to the ground and handcuffed inside the AmVets building on Sherrick Road Southeast. Police say he crashed his car into a utility pole, abandoned the vehicle, and ran into the building. The body cam video shows police going into the bar area and taking Tyson to the floor as he screamed that police officers were trying to kill him. Police got him onto the floor. One officer applied his knee to Tyson's back for about a minute as another police officer handcuffed him. Tyson said several times, quote, I can't breathe. And then less than a minute after officers handcuffed him, he went silent. The police officers left Tyson, who had been released from state prison earlier this month after serving a 24-year sentence for kidnapping, on the floor face down for nearly 8 minutes before an officer who handcuffed him realized he couldn't feel a pulse. He took the handcuffs off, and he and another officer applied chest compressions for several minutes. Canton police have turned the investigation over to the Ohio Bureau of Criminal Investigation, and officers Bo Shunegi and Camden Birch have been placed on administrative leave. The city showed the 35-minute video to Tyson's family before releasing it publicly. Today, we have released the body cam footage of the arrest incident involving the death of Mr. Frank E. Tyson, Mayor William V. Shirou II said in a prepared statement. I sat down with members of the Tyson family to not only allow them to see what is now being released to the public, but to give them my condolences in person. The police officer with the body camera arrived at the 1700 block of Sherrick Road at 8:24 p.m. Thursday to discover that a utility pole had been sheared, apparently by Tyson's vehicle. Much of the pole was hanging from the power lines. "The guy who did this, he is in the VFW. He ran in there," he said, "and his car's right here," said a passing motorist who stopped. The video was altered so witnesses in the video could not be identified. The police officer, accompanied by another officer, went toward the AmVets building. The officer found a vehicle with its airbag deployed, hazard lights flashing, and driver's door open in the front yard of a home by the building. As officers entered the building, a woman standing in the foyer told police, "Please get him out of here now." Tyson, standing at the bar wearing a white shirt and shorts, saw the police and was agitated. He yelled, "No," police officer said, "we're going outside. We're going outside. You ain't killing me," he said. "You ain't killing me tonight." The police officers grabbed Tyson by his arms. Tyson resisted, and a struggle began, with bar stools being knocked to the floor. Tyson yelled repeatedly, "They're trying to kill me. They're trying to kill me. Call the sheriff." The woman yelled that the police were trying to help him. As Tyson was on the floor yelling, an officer put his knee on Tyson's back and he was handcuffed. "I can't breathe," Tyson said. "I can't breathe." "Stop fighting," the police officer said. He then gurgled a few more words that were inaudible. At 8:30 p.m., the police officer, apparently seeing movement, told Tyson, "Calm down, stop fighting." At 8:34 p.m., more than 5 minutes after Tyson had spoken, another officer, looking down at Tyson on the floor, asked if Tyson had calmed down. "He might be out," the police officer said. "Is he breathing?" At 8:35, the police officer said to Tyson, "All right, stand up." He turned Tyson around onto his back. The officer began shaking Tyson. The police officers then turned him onto his side. "Come on, man," the police officer said. He tapped him a few more times. Another police officer said, "Is he breathing? I have medics coming." At 8:37, nearly 8 minutes after Tyson had last spoken, the police officer removed the handcuffs. "Does he have a pulse?" the other officer said. "I don't feel one." "Will you tell medics to step it up? He's not responsive. I don't know if I can feel a pulse." The police officer then began administering chest compressions. After a minute, another police officer took over. They also applied 2 doses of naloxone, a medication used to reverse opioid overdoses. Medics later arrived to take over. Now we move to the national news. This next article is entitled, "Overseas Campus Protest Not Like U.S." From London to Geneva, dueling groups of pro-Palestinian and pro-Israel demonstrators in Europe have for months been holding solidarity rallies, marches, and vigils in connection with the Israel-Hamas war. But they don't look like the Columbia University protest encampments and confrontations, which now have spread to other U.S. universities. From October 7th last year to mid-April, there have been more than 3,100 demonstrations in Europe related to the war in the Gaza Strip. In the U.S., over the same period, there have been about 2,700 such events. Pro-Palestinian protesters have demanded a ceasefire in the Gaza Strip and more aid for suffering Palestinians, called on their governments to stop supplying arms to Israel, and urged other forms of divestment. But unlike in the U.S., where some of the most prestigious universities have been trying to defuse campus tensions over the war, standoffs on European college campuses have either appeared limited or have flown under the radar. Precisely why that is, political experts and campaigners say, is not easy to explain. They say it could be because of different protesting cultures, demographics, speech laws, university regulations, policing habits, lack of viral traction on social media, and even opportunity. Some European governments have actively sought to place restrictions on the right to protest in support of Palestinian rights. Some say these standoffs have taken place and the media has largely ignored them. The next article is entitled, States Sue Over Abortion Accommodations Rule. Tennessee is leading a 17-state lawsuit over a federal rule entitling workers to certain accommodations for abortions, claiming the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission's rule is unconstitutional overreach. The states filed the lawsuit against the EEOC in federal district court in eastern Arkansas on Thursday. In it, they claim that new regulations to the Pregnant Workers Fairness Act, PWFA, go against the original intent of the law. Congress passed the bipartisan Pregnant Workers Fairness Act to protect mothers-to-be and promote healthy pregnancies, and the EEOC's attempt to rewrite that law into an abortion mandate is illegal, says Tennessee Attorney General Jonathan Scarametti. I'm proud to lead the coalition fighting to protect the law against this unconstitutional federal overreach. The legislation had wide bipartisan support in Congress when it passed in December 2022. It requires that employers provide reasonable accommodations to employees related to pregnancy, childbirth, or related medical conditions. The EEOC approved its final regulations for how to implement the law by a 3-2 vote on April 19th. Under the regulations, employers or health care providers are not required to provide or pay for abortions or expenses incurred from traveling for an abortion. The accommodations will typically be for time off work to receive and recover from an abortion, which will likely be unpaid, according to the EEOC. The states argue that the rule infringes on their sovereignty and exceeds the EEOC's statutory authority, an argument frequently used by conservatives against government regulation. The U.S. Supreme Court may soon overturn a judicial doctrine that courts should defer to agencies' interpretations of ambiguities in law, a move that some critics say would allow judges to impose their preferences into policy. The states also say that the application of the EEOC's rule to accommodate abortions will force the states to incur various costs, including lost productivity, shift covering, and provision of additional leave days. And the next article is entitled, Methodist Conference Moves Forward. The United Methodist Church's top legislative assembly passed key measure Thursday that could refashion the denomination's global structure and pave the way for greater regional autonomy on LGBTQ+ issues, just days into a two-week gathering. More than 700 delegates from around the world convened last week in Charlotte, North Carolina, to determine legislation expected to shape the long-term future of the nation's largest mainline Protestant denomination. A proposal known as regionalization is now among the highest profile of those decisions, in addition to the possible removal of anti-LGBTQ+ policies. The UMC has lost a quarter of its total U.S. churches in recent years due to splintering over church policy and theology, including LGBTQ+ rights. The overwhelming approval of key regionalization proposals called petitions by delegates Thursday is the first major sign of what many United Methodist leaders hope is a new chapter in the denomination's life. Are you willing to move forward in the spirit of hope and embrace a season of reformation? Are you committed to the revitalization of the United Methodist Church? Says New York Bishop Reverend Thomas Bickerton. We don't have any time for negative narratives and personal agendas. We've got work to do, he said. Guided by the principle of decolonization, regionalization seeks to address a longstanding power imbalance between United Methodist regional oversight in the U.S. versus that of other countries. The approach in essence, eliminates a regional hierarchy that the Methodist Church originally created in 1939 to racially segregate Black clergy and laity in the U.S. from the white population. Delegates approved on Thursday 5 of 8 key petitions that constitute the regionalization proposal to the UMC General Conference. Going forward, the constitutional amendment requires ratification from regional United Methodist bodies, a process that is expected to take a couple of years. On Thursday, UMC General Conference delegates passed other regionalization-related proposals by approving a consent calendar. Among those was a petition clarifying permission for a regional church policy on marriage, according to local customs and laws. Ahead of the Charlotte gathering, centrist and progressive United Methodist leaders and advocacy groups supported regionalization. Meanwhile, traditionalist advocacy groups opposed regionalization, partly due to its relationship with other efforts to remove anti-LGBTQ+ restrictions. During a floor debate Thursday, Filipina delegate Reverend Jonathan Yolande issued an ancient Greek term meaning, quote, a critical moment, saying, quote, worldwide regionalization is the kairos moment of equity, contextual ministry, and simultaneously dismantling the vestiges of colonialism in the structure of the United Methodist Church. Russian Bishop Reverend Edward Kelge expressed gratitude for his many positive experiences in the UMC in an address to delegates following the vote, repeating Boshu Spasibo, a Russian phrase expressing gratitude. Kelge added, quote, on behalf of our delegation from Eurasia, I want to express gratitude for supporting our autonomous status. We don't have any time for negative narratives and personal agendas, says Reverend Thomas Bickerton, who is Bishop of the United Methodist Church. And the next article is under the local buzz. Cedar Point's reimagined top thrill dragster roller coaster is about to launch. The ride has been idled since a mishap seriously injured a rider back in August 2021. There are some things riders will need to know before they get in line to climb aboard the Top Thrill 2, which will be the world's fastest triple launch strata coaster when it opens. 5 things you need to know. 1. All riders must be at least 52 inches tall. No loose articles, including cell phones, keys, lighters, and even lipstick, are permitted on the ride. All cell phones, purses, and loose articles must be left with a non-rider. And loose-fitting shoes or any shoe without a strap or back, including flip-flops, are not permitted on the ride. The Top Thrill 2 uses a safety restraint that must touch the top of the thighs of each rider. A test rider seat is located at the ride entrance to ensure proper fit of safety restraint. And now we move to today in history. Today is Monday, April 29th, the 120th day of 2024. There are 246 days left in the year. On this date, in 1429, Joan of Arc and her troops entered the besieged city of Orleans during the Hundred Years' War. She successfully broke through the siege, which gave the French a victory. In 1854, on this date, Lincoln University, originally the Ashmun Institute, was established as the nation's first degree-granting historically black college and university in Pennsylvania. The institution initially served African Americans who had very little access to higher education. It was renamed to honor President Abraham Lincoln in 1866. In 1945, on this date, the U.S. 7th Army liberated thousands of prisoners in the Nazi concentration camp of Dachau, Germany. The camp was the first to be established by the Nazi regime and became a model for other concentration camps. The number of prisoners were estimated to be about 200,000. And on this date in 1992, riots erupted across Los Angeles in response to the trial acquittals of four police officers indicted on the charges of assaulting Rodney King. In 2004, on this date, the final Oldsmobile passenger car was produced in Lansing, Michigan, ending America's oldest car brand. And in 2004, on this date, the World War II Memorial officially opened in Washington, D.C., located at the National Mall, designed by Friedrich St. Florian. The plaza is adorned with columns representing U.S. states and a Freedom Wall on the west side. The wall contains 4,048 gold stars, with each star honoring 100 Americans who died in the war. Well, that covers today's readings from the services of the Cincinnati Association for the Blind and Visually Impaired. My name is Mary Capicella. Have a great day and have a safe week.